Well, next week marks 30 years since the Tiananmen Square massacre, when China's ruling Communist Party ordered the military to retake the square from student-led pro-democracy protests, killing hundreds, perhaps thousands. It also snuffed out what was a glimmer of hope for political opening in China, whose government strictly forbids discussion and commemoration of those events. But June the 4th, 1989 was also pivotal in convincing the Chinese Communist Party that it could not tolerate an open internet like the one emerging in the West. What happened next and how China is spreading its controlled and surveilled version of the internet around the world is the subject of a book by CNN journalist James Griffiths. It's called The Great Firewall of China, How to Build and Control an Alternative Version of the Internet. James Griffiths is currently in Australia and joined me in the PM studio.
The first kind of steps towards connecting China to the global internet take place in 1987. Obviously, 2 years later, you've got 1989 and the Tiananmen protests and massacre, and both sides of that pretty quickly come to an understanding of what the internet could have done if it had been, you know, widespread at the time, if you'd have had the whole of China connected at the time of Tiananmen. The government recognises the potential danger of that, and also the activists recognise the potential advantages. And so you see kind of both sides racing to try and get more connected, and then also the government to really reining it in and put the first blocks of what we now call the Great Firewall into place.
We in the West have always thought it's such a slippery fish. It's like herding cats, to mix the metaphors. How could you possibly control the internet? How do they do it?
The reason China's been so good at this is because they've kind of baked it in from the beginning. We have two types of the internet that we're dealing with. We have, you know, our own like national internet, so that you're request goes to your ISP and your internet provider, and then, you know, at some point that is entering the international internet where it's getting piped around the world, you know, via undersea cables and stuff. And obviously at certain points things have to cross over borders, and China from the beginning has controlled all of those borders around China, and so that's where it's been able to put in filters to say, you know, we don't want certain types of websites, and, you know, to surveil content and say we don't want certain types of content. And that's how they've been able to really, you know, clamp down and control what people can see and what they can talk about.
I mean, I guess at one level, if Chinese citizens can go shopping on the internet through their shopping services, can have social media interactions through Chinese only social media, what's the problem?
Yeah, and that's another, you know, major reason that the Great Firewall has been such a success. You know, I think if we cut Australia off from the entire rest of the global internet, and, you know, you didn't have Facebook and you didn't have Twitter and you didn't have Amazon, you know, people might feel a lot, you know, a lot more cut off, a lot more isolated. Whereas China has a lot of domestic services and it has a kind of population that can really, you know, support quality services and you know, competition between them. And so for most people, they don't, you know, necessarily notice the lack of Facebook or Twitter or anything like that, or Google. But the really kind of pernicious censorship which happens inside China is not keeping out foreign services. It's controlling what happens on services in China. So when you are on your Chinese social media, you're on Weibo or you're on WeChat, you are being both hyper surveilled by the companies and the government. And then also what you can talk about is being controlled. If you try and post certain things, they'll be deleted. If you try and have certain discussions, it's been shown that, you know, your messages just simply won't show up if you try and message someone about something controversial. And, you know, and then it times of real sensitivity, which we'll see early next month, June 4th, the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre, there will be even more control and even more limiting of what people can say.
And let's stay with Tiananmen for a second, because you tell the story of some students who, I think it was on the 20th anniversary or roundabout there, suddenly, Chinese students suddenly discovered this thing called the Tiananmen Square massacre. What happened there?
I mean, in the book, one of the characters in my book who lived in, he eventually moved to Australia, as it happens. And you know, he was a student in China at the time, and they were trying to download some movies, and they found that one of these, you know, pirated movies they downloaded turned out to be a documentary about Tiananmen Square. And they had watched it, and they had... You know, they had ideas about it. There were these kind of, you know, whispered things about Tiananmen. It wasn't this kind of completely unknown subject, but it really opened a kind of floodgate for them for, you know, sharing, connecting the various stories that their family had told them to the wider story of what had happened, the student movement, seeing students like themselves, you know, really kind of fighting for democracy in 1989, and then also what happened afterwards.
And I guess a moment of realization for them about what their government was doing with information, crucial information.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what you could say. One of the interesting things in it, the character that I talked to in the book, Bajie Cao, he's a relatively well-known Australian-based Chinese dissident. He obviously became a very strong critic of the government. Another one of his roommates became a public security bureau officer working for the government. So, you know, access to information doesn't always lead to the kind of realizations you might expect.
So we've talked about, I guess, you know, what it means for people inside of China. What does the Great Firewall, what else is China doing with the Great Firewall at this time of China's massive expansion in the world as a power?
Yeah, so the Great Firewall has always been kind of dangerous when it comes to global internet freedom, because it's always been this, you know, inspiration or this kind of shining light to any, you know, authoritarian censor around the world. They've been able to look at China and say, well, they can control the internet. Why don't we try and do that ourselves? And that's kind of ramped up in recent years, in that China's actively going to people and saying, hey, do you want to censor your internets? Here are the tools. Here is a Chinese company you can buy all of your networking infrastructure from. That company will also, you know, sell you the various surveillance tools and things like that. And then also we'll also help you write your laws in a way that follow ours, that kind of can rein in a lot of this speech and match our type of, they call it cyber sovereignty, which is the kind of political thought behind this type of censorship. And they do trainings for government ministers from around the world. We'll fly off to Beijing and learn from them. And that's really, really had an effect. We've seen in Africa, in, you know, parts of South America, all over the world. I talk about Uganda in my book, where they've invested heavily in Chinese surveillance tech, internet infrastructure, and then also going to Beijing to you know, pretty openly learn from Chinese officials of how to control the internet.
And of course, that's then not just about controlling the internet, is it? It's about ideas of how you run a society. It's way more fundamental, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it's, we've seen this really ramping up in recent months, actually, you know, with the, you know, you saw after the horrific terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka, there were, you know, there was an immediate ban on social media with the kind of justification being, you know, that we need to stop the spread of fake news, or we need to stop panic spreading. And then that also involves blocking WhatsApp. I mean, I was in Sri Lanka at the time covering it as a journalist, and you know, no one I spoke to agreed with this you know, reasoning that the government was giving. You know, it was much more about kind of, from people's perspective, it was much more about controlling criticism of the government on social media, and preventing people from, you know, taking their anger and turning that into some kind of political movement that might, you know, threaten their power. And that's a lot of times what this comes down to. It's not so much the content that's being spread on the internet, it's how the internet is being used to potentially organize against any government.
And so if we look in this region, for example, the Pacific Island states, traditionally Australia's backyard, but China's very powerful there, and Australia's now very worried about that. Is the internet, the idea of China's internet, likely to be sold to those states, do you think, by China?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've seen, I've reported on in Fiji, they've passed laws, and, you know, often these laws are presented very kind of positively. The law in Fiji that passed recently was presented as cracking down on revenge porn and on, you know, kind of cyberbullying and stuff. And, you know, looks on the face of it like a nice positive law protecting young people online, and then happens to have a couple of clauses that are very, very vaguely worded and will, you know, give the government a lot of power to censor content and censor criticism of government officials and stuff like that. So you do see this, you know, Chinese style kind of internet regulation spreading across the region, and certainly spreading to countries where China has influence.
And so where do you see this going? Because if the idea of an open internet, the exchange of information being open on the internet, the kind of freedom idea that we've all sort of absorbed over the years, if that's, I guess, a fundamental for our democracies, for liberal democracies, where do you see this going as China challenges that?
Yeah, and this is what's kind of so dangerous about China challenging it at this time, and it's possibly why they're having so much success, because obviously there's a lot of skepticism about these ideas at the moment, you know, justifiably. You know, there's a lot of fear about, you know, after things like Christchurch and, you know, things like fake news and you know, and also, you know, like Fiji, things like revenge porn and, you know, the internet being used in a lot of horrific ways. And because there is skepticism, justifiable skepticism, in that kind of free and open and, you know, information wants to be free type attitude, you know, you do see some governments warming to China's idea of how to control the internet. And then unfortunately, you also see some governments, including this government in Australia, passing knee-jerk legislation very, very quickly without, you know, without kind of too much thought and without much input from, you know, especially rights bodies and also industry groups. And, you know, I think that's very dangerous. We can protect our version of the internet. That doesn't mean we need to let everything happen online and we're hopeless to prevent online terrorism or, you know, online hate spreading. But that also doesn't mean we rush to pass legislation that kind of clamps down on everything and stops people being able to, you know, exercise their free speech online.
So in a sense, China's opened a Pandora's box, not just in developing countries where it has potential financial leverage, but also in Western democracies.
Mm. Yeah.
James Griffiths, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.